The following is brought to you by the Starfleet Podcast Network, SPN, The Spin.
I know I've mentioned this before, but the audience has to feel they know the parameters of your show. They have to know if they tune into an Antilles episode, whether it's 1 or 24 or 30, they know what they're going to get.
On a red alert.
Hey, this is Big J, and in just a moment, I'll be presenting you with Starship Antilles, Episode 12. Afterwards, please join our critical, not cynical review for discussions and reactions to the film. Without further ado, here is Starship Antilles, Episode 12.
Captain's log, Stardate 5440.6. The Antilles has been cleared to continue her mission. We left Repair Base 145 2 days ago and have been conducting tests with our new systems. For the moment, all is quiet. And I feel now is the time to have my talk with Dr. Miles on matters of grave importance.
I just finished with the crew physicals, Captain. Medically, everyone, with the exception of yourself, is ready to go.
Excellent. And now we can discuss why I asked you here.
You know, I'm curious. Ever since you got back from your temple visit, you seem somehow different.
I feel as though a veil has been lifted from my eyes, Miles.
A part of me I thought was lost forever has returned.
How so?
There are no words to describe what I've gone through. I've been so angry and sad over the loss of Natalie that it was eating me up. After my visit to the Temple of Vision, my desire to live and make each day count returned. The sadness has been relegated to the back. But it's no longer my dominant state of mind.
You'll have to forgive my skepticism, Holt, but how can you be so changed by a vision?
This wasn't like a dream. This was reality. With an overall purpose. To teach me, or to show me some higher truth. Nobody understands how the temple works. But no matter the reason, it has helped me.
I'm on a new path now.
I want to do a full workup on you, Captain. I want to make sure you're not under some alien influence or drugs.
This is the real deal, Miles.
Yeah, we'll see.
Do you remember our mission to the Caldor Sector 3 years ago?
Yeah, we discovered some city office building and some atmosphere bubble, as I recall.
Yes, but I'm thinking what happened right before that.
You came down with an illness. Maybe the Andorian flu, as I recall.
Not the flu, Doctor. I know what it is now.
Well, the tests were inconclusive. What do you think it was?
The answer is 247. Starbase 247.
Wasn't that the base we stopped at just before the Caldos mission?
Exactly. I was invited down to the base to have a meeting with Admiral Straub, who was visiting himself at the time.
What? Something happened at the meeting?
No, but there was an incident after the meeting. Something so minor, I didn't realize its significance until after I had my vision. What seemed like an accident was done on purpose. And shortly after, the Antilles went off on its mission to the Caldo sector, and suddenly, I wasn't feeling well.
My God. You were poisoned. But who did it, and why?
I believe it was Northon, or somebody that worked for him. For some reason, the poison didn't kill me, only made me sick. But I believe it also provides an explanation for why I'm still alive right now.
The first time didn't kill. But the second time he poisoned you, he wasn't aware that you had built up an immunity of sorts.
Not enough to save me in the long run. But it is buying me some time right now.
You know, it all makes sense now. I could test your samples for the Druidanium poison. now that I know what to look for and confirm your theory.
While you work on that, there's something else I need to do.
And what is that?
There's a mystery surrounding Natalie's death, and I intend to solve it once and for all.
I thought Northon caused her accident.
I believe there's more to the story. Call it a gut feeling.
And I know who to contact first to get the ball rolling.
Time. It's good to see you again.
Yes, and you as well, Captain. But, we're on a secure channel, quite alone. This isn't a social call, is it?
Your instincts are right on target, my friend. This isn't exactly Starfleet business. It's personal. I'm trying to solve a mystery. And I need good people to help me. Let me just say this up front. If you're unwilling or can't help, there'll be no hard feelings.
Captain. Holt. I've got you back. What can I do for you?
It's regarding the circumstances of Natalie's accident. There was an official inquest at Starbase 247. And whatever they discovered has been classified as top secret.
Even from a starship captain?
So it would appear.
Well, I have a knack for poking my nose where it doesn't belong. It annoys people, and that makes me happy. So, what can I do for you?
Rumor has it that you know the security director's brother at Starbase 247, and that he may owe you certain favors.
Yeah, party with an Orion woman and you'll do things and get into career. Although he was fortunate that I was able to fix things for him. Although I had to burn a lot of favors to do it. So yeah, he owes me.
Okay, that sounds promising.
You want me to ask about the inquest information files?
If possible, I want a copy of those files. My instincts tell me. It's vital.
I'll see what I can do. Captain. No one knows better than I do that there comes a point when it's time to bury the past. You can't bring Natalie back.
Maybe not. But finding out what happened may allow me to move on. You know?
Say no more. Let me see what I can do. It may take some time.
I've waited this long. I appreciate anything you can do, Eric. But keep it as quiet as you can. I know there are people just watching to see if I mess up my command to get rid of me.
I know the feeling. Don't worry. I'll be in touch. Hang in there, Captain.
Bridge to Captain. Incoming message.
Pipe it down here, Starlin.
Captain Allen.
Admiral Hill, it's good to see you again.
There is yet another crisis. Your orders are on the way. Resolve this.
Aye, sir. As soon as we receive the data packet, we'll get underway.
Holt, I knew I could count on you.
Thank you, Admiral. We'll do our best.
Admiral Hill out.
Captain's log, supplemental. The Antilles has been ordered into the Threndets sector to solve the riddle of why many ships have gone missing. The Threndets are a member of the Federation, and I'm lucky to have one on board my ship. Lieutenant Sharb is his name, and according to Admiral Hill, is considered an expert in this region.
Welcome to the bridge, Mr. Sharb. Are you ready for the mission at hand?
Yes. My thought translator is online, negating the use of my mouth, which we use only for food consumption. I take it this form of communication is acceptable?
Of course, Mr. Sharb. I am quite familiar with your species. I take it this mission should prove to be of some interest to you?
My only hope is to solve the central mystery. What is causing so many ships to disappear in this region?
A good question. But I shouldn't have to tell you that it will take some time before we learn anything. Or maybe it will never happen.
That would be unacceptable. With my knowledge and your capable ship and crew, I am certain we will succeed.
If you say so.
I just did.
All right, Brooks, I want a long-range scan.
Aye, sir.
I have provided your officers with all the facts as we currently know.
I'd like to be as prepared as possible. Can you give us any indication what we can expect?
Speculation is all well and good, Captain, but I prefer facts.
That is logical.
As a telepathic species, we do not wish to crowd each other's minds with unnecessary clutter. We've learned to keep it simple and to the point whenever possible.
Your people do have the best poker faces in the galaxy.
Yes, we do. A most excellent game, this poker. We, Threndrets, have embraced it fully. One would think we invented it. That's how proficient we are at it.
We must play a game sometime, Mr. Sharb. I do enjoy a challenge.
Then it will happen. Although I might feel bad for defeating someone I respect so highly.
Of course.
Captain, I've completed a full long-range scan of this sector.
Excellent. Mr. Sharb, we have arrived. Are you ready to take the lead on this?
Indeed. I believe you'll find that I am considered the ultimate authority when it comes to this sector and the strange events surrounding it.
It's the reason why you're here, Mr. Sharb. I am very aware of your qualifications.
You are most perceptive. A mark of an excellent captain.
Science Station 2 is right over there. Feel free to use it.
I will coordinate with Mr. Brooks. Having an extra set of eyes to back my observations is preferable.
Coordinate with Mr. Sharb.
Is that clear, Brooks?
Aye, sir.
Mr. Desrock, I want your observation as well. I have no intention of vanishing without a trace. We're here to solve the mystery, not be a part of one.
Consider it done.
This is a fairly large area we have to cover. I predict a wait of some significance before anything happens.
Noted. I still want detailed observations. We might discover something overlooked during periods of inactivity. Mr. Zizrock, I don't want to add to your list of responsibilities, but I want a last transmission analysis from all the ships considered lost in the region.
A sound idea, Captain.
You'll discover that the majority of lost ships sent no messages, Captain, which suggests that whatever happened to them was quick and deadly. A fate which I hope we can avoid.
Another day, another Federation credit. Bored already? The shift just started.
You don't understand. I signed up with Starfleet for the adventure.
Not the button-pushing kind. It's Data 5 all over again.
Well, don't let the captain hear you say that, or your department head. Data 5 is the place you run away from, not comparing it to life on a spaceship.
Easy for you to say. Enjoy quietly researching theories that swim around in that head of yours. Man, the more away from it all you are, the better you enjoy life. Am I right?
As always, Sophie. Hey, guys.
Soph is looking bored again.
Funny. We're off duty. Do you guys want to grab a bite to eat with us?
I suppose, as long as it's not that awfully boring salmon from...
There's that word again. How could you be bored with eating?
It's not a crime to want some excitement in life.
Don't say things like that. It only invites trouble.
Not very scientific, Chris.
It's still true. What did I just say?
All hands, this is the captain. Red alert. I repeat, red alert. Everyone is to report to their duty stations immediately.
Now that's more like it.
Report.
Alien object. Could be a life form. Or a ship.
Unknown. Nothing registers from the Starfleet database.
Everyone, stay calm. Whatever this is, may have nothing to do with the vanishing ships. But just in case, stay alert, everyone. Shields and weapons at the ready.
Standing by, sir.
Readings are confused, Captain.
How so?
The object is reading has artificial and living at the same time. A possible combination of the two, or something else altogether.
Anything to add to this, Mr. Brooks?
It's not registering as a life form.
Okay, let's assume this is a new life form. Let's stay with it. But not too close. I don't want it to feel threatened. Starling, keep an ear open for any transmissions it might be broadcasting.
Opening channels, sir.
All channels, all frequencies, through the Universal Translator. If it wants to talk, I'm all for it.
Aye, sir.
It is projecting fluctuating energies. This is making it hard to get a read on it.
When you say projecting, are you suggesting an attack?
Hard to say. My guess, and this is all that it is at this stage, is that the object is protecting itself. Ah, I might be right. It is accelerating away. Captain, this needs to be studied. We shouldn't let it get away until we have a little more information.
Very well, Mr. King. Stay on the alien, but at a safe distance. I don't want to scare it into acting out of desperation.
Playing it safe is all well and good, Captain. But this might be a confirmation on some old tales told by the various planets living in this region.
Old tales?
Stories. Not unlike Earth's ancient matter and history. They reported strange encounters with unknown life. They referred to their encounters with things called... sea monsters.
Mr. King, let that ship have some distance, but don't lose them. Well, they have my attention. Maintain pursuit, but do not return fire.
The energy signal was powerful, but right now I can't say if they can't generate more. However, for the technological level in the sector, it would be enough to knock out the majority of ships that have vanished.
Where there's smoke, there's fire, as the saying goes. But I want more proof before we presume they're guilty. In relation to the other missing ships, what is its location since attacking us?
This is where the majority of ships were reported missing. Captain, either they are guilty of the attacks, or they may think we are responsible for them. We have to find out either way. This case can only be solved by knowledge. That object may hold the key to answering our questions.
As Mr. Tzrock would say, that is logical. Navigator, helmsman, prepare to overtake the vessel. Red alert, everyone. Red alert.
Data being relayed to the science station. Closing fast.
Bring us to a stop as well, Mr. King.
Aye, sir.
Readings are in flux. The alien ship, if that's what it is. Captain, energy readings increasing.
Shields to maximum. Helmsman, back us up.
Energy expanding. Explosion in 2 seconds.
Hold on. What the hell just happened? Where are we?
A strange pattern has emerged. It is a corrosive zone. Like a stomach of some giant organism.
Hold our position here, Helm.
We have to get out of here before the ship succumbs to the forces operating on it.
We need to see if there's an exit out of here. Brooks, any luck finding an opening?
Too much interference to get a clear reading.
We need to reconfigure the ship's scanner to read flux currents. The weaker ones will be the nearest exit. It's essential we do it fast. The energy acid, for lack of a better term, is eating away at the shields. Soon, it will eat away at the ship itself. And that will be that.
Agreed. And I know the team to do it. Lab 5, this is the captain speaking.
Lab 5 here.
Lieutenant, I want you and your team to reconfigure the sensors. As of right now, we're blind and we have nowhere to go. This is critical. We only have a short time before this area destroys us. Is that clear, Lieutenant?
Yes, Captain.
Let us hope there is time.
Yes. In the meantime, does anyone have any theories as to what the hell happened to us?
This is a multi-dimensional creature. Feeds off specific energies, uses the butterfly to lure other ships towards it, and then eats it.
I don't want to kill it. It's a life form acting out of instinct. If possible, I want us to get out of here without destroying it.
If we can navigate out of here, I can give the alien a sour stomach, and it may vomit us out.
Wonderful. Let's do it. Captain's log, supplemental. The Intellis has entered an area we are calling the digestive zone. The ongoing theory is that we are inside an interdimensional life form, more specifically, its stomach, and we are under attack by space enzymes trying to dissolve us for food. Our shields are holding for now, but time is running out. Report.
Unable to read the way out, but it must exist somewhere. Waiting on the Lab 5 team. But we are running out of time, Captain.
Readings on the nature of those energy swirls.
Scanners are being interfered with.
If it's alive, it's vulnerable.
If we could read where its sides are, maybe a photon torpedo or concentrated phases might do the trick.
You mean give this thing an ulcer?
Exactly.
Damn! It's okay, Joel. The captain's depending on us.
It's alright. It's going to be alright.
Shield status.
Captain, we're down to emergency power, sir.
Damn. Contact Lab 5 for a progress report.
Aye, sir.
Mr. King, pick a direction, any direction, and prepare to warp us out on my word.
Warp speed might not work in this environment, Captain. Impulse power will be available, however.
Great. Just great. Mr. King, be prepared to use whatever we have.
Yes, sir. Readings are off the charts. Lab 5 has an excellent interstellar scanner for this sort of problem.
Activate sensors. Find us the way out.
I see it. Coordinating with navigation station now.
Captain's log, supplemental. The Antilles stands ready to fire an energy pulse designed to give this creature a sour stomach. This will hopefully give us a chance to escape the digestive zone. I have faith in Lieutenant Sharp, Brooks, and my science team. Failure is not an option with our very existence on the line. It's now or never, as they say. Prepare to fire the pulse on my word. All hands, we are trying to exit the zone. I want full power to the emitters. Fire the energy pulse. All available power to shields and engines. Get us out of here.
It is going to be close.
Power to the engines. Hang on, everyone. Stay on course.
We're through, sir.
Incredible. All stations report in. I want to know the ship status. Well done, everyone. Especially to you, Mr. Sharp. I don't know about you, but I could use a few more Threndrits on this ship.
But of course.
Mr. Tzrak, we have to warn any future ships in the area if the butterfly ship makes a reappearance.
Brooks, I want a full report. We have to give this information to the Science Academy.
Yes, sir.
Hopefully the creature will move on to another sector if it gets hungry enough. But all warnings will be out there. And that should be enough to protect everyone.
The creature might have to go hungry for a while, but if we can prevent any casualties, I'm all for it.
I concur.
Excellent work by all involved. Lab 5 in particular. Impressive.
Yes. I will go down there personally and thank them. They did an incredible job. Mr. King, set us a course to the nearest starbase.
Yes, sir.
Warp 2, if you please.
It will take some time to sort out all those readings we got on the creature as we were leaving.
I must say, Sharp, you did an incredible job.
But of course...
I can't wait for our poker game.
You will lose.
Maybe. But never count a starship captain out when the odds are against us. We do love a challenge.
Welcome back to Critical Not Cynical. Thank you for watching the film. We're sitting here with writer, actor, director George Kahan. He's going to talk to us about Starship Antilles in the episode that you just watched or listened to. George, thank you very much for being here with us tonight.
My honor, Jefferson. Thank you for having me back. I've been looking forward to this.
So to take us through your story. I know this this episode, there's certainly a lot that you need to watch prior, and there's an ongoing series. But just for anyone who watched it and is like, wait a minute, what's going on here? Can you give an overview as to where we're at right now in this episode of the story?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. As my series is one giant story, that's the danger of anyone that comes along late. Of course, they're going to feel like, oh, wait, I missed something. The game plan, of course, is to have you go back from the beginning and watch it so you fully enjoy it. But if that's not the case, this is as close to a standalone episode as I have in my series, mm-hmm. but it still has to be connected in some way. And I'm hoping you guys will cover episode 11 because that's also a standalone and yet a connected episode. But there was a mystery regarding this number, this 247, which the captain was haunted by. He couldn't quite put it together. But ultimately, and this doesn't give too much away, it does connect in with our very first episode, our pilot episode. And it also connects very heavily with where episode 11 leaves off. So in this episode that you just watched, it's answering that question about what episode 11 put up, like, what is this 247? So, yeah, you do have an answer now in the beginning of this episode. And the way I structured it was, okay, we got to answer this question of what is 247. And that's when I decided to contact Vance and have Vance enter into my show. And then from there, it's a standalone episode. It doesn't really connect with the rest of the story from that part on. It's just a separate Star Trek episode. And the reason why I felt that was important was the captain, he's still a captain of a starship. And they're going to be sent on missions that are not related to his personal business. So I thought it was important to have some of those episodes where, look, he's a starship captain. He's got other things that he has to perform. So I like the fact that the episode connects and then has its own little niche, as far as the story goes. Vance was very important because my character, despite the fact that some critics have said he's like a Mary Sue, he just does everything. I don't think that's true at all. If you watch the entire show, and there is ultimately, I won't give it away, there is a reason why he does seem to guess right on a lot of occasions. And I do address that in one of the most recent episodes, as a matter of fact. And when you see that answer, it'll definitely be a, oh, I get it kind of moment. But in the early part of the show, he can't do everything. And so I wanted Vance to come in with his character and be like, look, I need some answers. Can you get these for me? And it was a great way of getting Vance involved in my show, not only because I love the guy, but he was one of my favorite heroes, doing his own series. But I like the idea that Holt Allen needs help and says, hey, can you get me some information here? Because I can't do it. And so it's very important. I don't treat any of my guest stars as frivolous. Everyone has they're an important block in the building of that wall. And of course, Sharb was introduced in this episode. And full disclosure, Sharb was supposed to be a one and done. My daughter was just going to make that one appearance. And I got so many calls and comments after the episode aired saying, oh, the Sharb is like my new favorite character, that I immediately said, well, maybe I could bring the character back. And then my daughter Anya had such a great time playing it. I said, okay, a little bit of nepotism here. Would you like to join, the show? And she's loved the ride ever since.
That is awesome. That's great to be able to have your daughter be a part of it like that, which is spectacular. I'll open up the floor for Vance and Frank.
I was going to say what I really enjoyed about this, George, was the fact that this is where you brought Sharbin. So I thought it was really cool, from that point in seeing the very beginning. But, as any of your films go, and as I said, I've seen almost all of them. Yeah, you do have to have that certain amount for this, but this is a good standalone episode. There was one character in there, you could have probably done without, but
No, he didn't.
Such an extra scene that it slowed down the entire episode.
It came was like a crawl. You know, he should have just deleted. You know, that
I'm on YouTube.
I gotta honestly say that when Vance did that for me, and I got the footage, I was blown away by his acting. He took the idea of the scene honestly, and I thought his acting was superb because. You know, in a lot of productions, you know, a lot of characters are larger than life, but you always want to ground it with some realism. And I felt that you got the vibe that Vance and I in the universe of my show were friends, even though we hadn't met him yet.
Yeah.
That when Holt says, "Hey, I need a favor," and then, you know, Vance shows up, I believed it. I believe we had a history you didn't see at that point. But Vance acting wise, honestly, you blew me out of the water. It was absolutely gold to edit that footage and work with you on that.
Thank you. Yeah. No, the thing I enjoyed about this was it's always kind of different. Having made, you know, my own films, it's you have your own outlook on a character, but it's always interesting to kind of step into someone else's sandbox. You know, like Joseph Pita, Gary Davis, Josh, you know, their take on your character. And this was a little different to kind of see, well, what's Menard like through George's eyes, you know? And I love how, when you say, "Hey, I kind of want Menard to do this," you know, you do see, Menard and Holt Allen, you know, I think if you were to have your perfect Star Trek, you know, it would be kind of a buddy cop movie, you know, of them just doing in a shuttlecraft together, just going around doing whatever, you know. And I get that vibe every time you write or have something for Menard. And it's always a pleasure to come in and take that spin, because it's not, you know, whenever I write Menard, he's always broody and moody and staring off into space. He's got that Michael Keaton Batman, just I'm mad at the world type vibe. But whenever he's talking to Holt, he doesn't have that weight of the world on his shoulders. And like when he's talking to you and he says, you know, "Hey, you can't carry all this shit with you, man. And I've been there," you know, and it's that whole, like, I don't have to carry that with me. And hey, don't go down that road. You know, it's a nice change of pace, you know? And I love your writing style. And the thing is, like, when I was rewatching this, because again, you've made so many films, they all blur together, so I kind of forget which ones are which.
Me too.
It was, yeah, like it's crazy, isn't it? Like after you, like, I forget the names or the, you know, which one. But when you told me, you're like, "Hey," the first time when we did the CNC, and you're like, "Hey, watch this one or watch this one," and I was like, "Okay." And then you're like, "You know, this one is the introduction of Sharp." I was like, "Oh, awesome!" So I knew we'd get to this one. Like, I forgot that I was even in this one. So when I saw my name pop up, I was like, "Oh, that fat fuck, what's he doing there?" You know? But I was so happy to see Sharb, because it's like, it's kind of like when you are watching Orville and they expand in the second season and you're like, "Oh, this is the first season was great, but the second season they've matured and they're ready to go on." And that's where this is, like, as much as I love your earlier stuff, like when Sharb comes in, it gives you that chance to kind of loosen the collar a little bit, breathe, and you get to expand your universe and go on. And I love the inclusion of that character, especially the fact knowing that it's your daughter, Anya, and getting to, you know, be creative in a way that you can't with, you know, stock footage that you've recorded. It gets you, to me, it's exciting, because I'm like, what are they going to do next? You know, and you're so clever on what you do. So this episode, it was a pleasure to get to see that again. When you're off work on the weekend, it's midnight, you flip on the TV and you're like, "Oh, I've seen this John Wayne episode. I'm going to sit and watch this." And it's whenever I'm watching your films, that's what it always feels like. 'Cause it's like memory lane again. I don't watch them all too often, but when I do, it's like, I like this, you know, it's always a treat watching your stuff. So.
Thanks, Vance. Appreciate that.
Yeah. You know, I remember the last time we were talking about, you know, your thoughts about, you know, the story arc and how long it's taken to do it. And I was watching some of the scenes in there. And now when I watch your movies, I'm trying to figure out what scenes you filmed and threw in there because you knew that people were going to be going on their way. So I'm trying to guess, and I'm trying to say, so could this have been in one of his films before that he recycled because that person isn't available right now? So it's interesting that I'm looking for that now, just to see that. I think when you brought that up, I just said, this is Frank's new challenge while watching Gorgeous films.
I appreciate that.
I love it. I really do.
It's a puzzle. It's definitely a puzzle. In every single episode, though, there are moments from 2012 and then whatever year I'm working on that particular episode. And now that I'm reaching the end of my show, it's all over the map. It could be a call and response from 2012, a response from 2016, and then whatever I'm working on currently. The thing is, it's all the same materials. It's all the same camera. So in a weird way, it doesn't matter how old the footage is, because it's not like I'm mixing and matching, you know.
You can't tell.
Yeah.
You really can't tell. I have not been able to pick it up. A couple times I thought when Brooks turns around like this, I don't know whether that's the same one, but Brooks always seems to turn around like this.
Yeah. The actress who plays Brooks, I actually did about 25, 30 takes where I just told her, just look to your left, just look to your right. And knowing that I would need insert shots, you know, down the line. She was the first to leave the cast because she got married and moved to Canada.
How dare her.
I know.
Marriage, boo.
She was a joy to film with. I love her very much. She's family. But she has two kids now. She lives in Canada. And the last time I filmed with her was, I think, late 2015. And I haven't really been able – yeah, I mean, I've seen her since. When she comes to family functions, you know, when she's back into the United States. But you don't realize how much time has gone by, how much, you know, I haven't filmed with her live. As a matter of fact, when she told me she was going to move to Canada, I actually spent a final day of shooting with her. And that's footage nobody's seen yet. There's actually I've been saving this footage for the last couple episodes. You're going to see brand new footage that I shot back in the day, but it does wrap up her character. But it, you know, I didn't need to show it yet because you'll see how it plays out in the final episodes, but it does give you closure to that character. I've been sitting on that footage now for a couple of years. Yeah.
Wow.
But you know, that's, you know, I knew that all of us that make fan films struggle to keep our cast together. And I remember from day one, when we had our cast, I said, I know, guys, that life has to take precedent, and I know we're not going to be able to do this forever. But I made sure that whenever I did have someone to film with, I always shot more. I said, while I have you here. And so what I ended up doing was, because I knew my story in advance, not every single individual episode, I just wrote what I would call my generic Star Trek dialogue that could fit in any number of situations. And I just had my cast do it. And I accounted for all my bridge officers, every kind of situation you can imagine. I had them say things in times of stress, in times of, you know, they're heading for shore leave, whatever the situation was. Every one of my actors had that about 25, 30 lines that I could now place in the future. And I'm so glad I did that because you know what? People change a lot. And I'm so glad for continuity because in my show, not a lot of time goes by. I think in total, if you watch all 30 episodes, it's like a 3 or 4 year time period. And yet in real life, you shoot someone in 2012, 2013, and then shoot them now. People change in a very short time.
Well, especially your daughter, when your daughter on there and Royce, the same thing.
She's almost as tall. Yeah, right? She's almost as tall as me.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
So, you know, I know
for me personally, like I started shooting Constar, the motion picture, and we started the first scene. It was, I think, 11 months ago, we started writing. and getting everything set up. And we shot scene one, I think it was maybe October or September of last year. Mm-hmm. And you watch the footage, because we've been shooting like one scene a month of the film. And we just got done shooting, I think, his almost next to last scene that he needs to shoot before we actually go to the studio in September. And he's grown just as an actor, he's grown so much. But as a kid, he's grown so much from that very first scene. And we've shot in synchronous order, you know. And it's just, man, in just that short amount of time, and it hasn't even been a full 8 months that we've been there. And I can only imagine Anya, how she's grown, you know, from the very first episode that she's been in till now, you know. I mean, but it's also history that these kids have gone through, their history, that they've lived it, you know, and that's amazing. It's so amazing.
See, what you have to do is what I did. Let your kids grow up before you Shanghai one of them. Because I've got my daughter, my baby in there now, Shannon. She's playing an ensign called Beverly Long, who is my mother's maiden name.
Oh, interesting.
I do things like that. I do things like that.
George, you raise an interesting question that I had. So you're talking about filming extra, which I think is a great idea. You're doing a series that is 30 episodes. You started in 2012. Is that right?
Yeah, we actually started filming by 2013, but I was writing it in 2012. Yeah.
Okay. Well, there are a lot of different TV shows you can use as an example, even Star Trek. Not every series, but I know TNG is one. You can tell that they changed their camera at some point there. I think it was around maybe the third season. If you really know what you're looking for, you can kind of tell, okay, this is a different camera. And we certainly see that with our stuff, like between my phone here and this digital video camera I've got, it's very different. Like I could not do two different angles with one thing and put it in the same film. It would be very difficult to make it look like it's, you know, one piece. So the question I've got is, how are you able to incorporate that, knowing there's a possibility that things you filmed in 2013, 2014, that now you want to do a character shot in 2024, that you're using something different? Does that make you hold on to old equipment that you have to pretty much, you know, pray and hope that it never breaks?
That's a great question. Yeah, I was determined to use the same camera that I started with. And the camera did break. It did malfunction. And so I had to do research. It was a discontinued camera. It's a Sony Handycam that can shoot widescreen. It was, for its time, considered like very professional. And then it quickly got out-teched by the newer digital cameras, but I was never going to switch to that. I went online, I found a refurbished one, I got a second one. And then, and they used to be extremely expensive back in the day, and then they're getting cheaper because nobody wants them. So then I bought a third one, the exact same camera. And then I lost my second camera during filming. It actually got knocked down off its tripod and crashed into the street.
Oh,
and it broke my heart, because out of all my Sony Handycams, that one, for whatever reason, was my best camera. It shot in-depth shots the best. It had the most depth of field, but she got totaled. So I was down to one camera again out of my original two. And then I went and I found a fourth one. So I have a backup camera, same camera. So I'll be able to finish my series with that original camera. And I tell you the truth, I know digital cameras are amazing, but being a very visual person, I like the color saturation and the way the film looks, the video, I should say, mm-hmm. with the way the Sony Handycam shoots it. I like the look. It softens edges. It makes my sets look really good, kind of hides the, you know, the cheapness of the sets in a way. I'm so comfortable with that camera. I know what it can do. I know how far I can push it. I know what it's capable of. It's like an extension of me. Yeah. And that's another reason why. Now, in the meantime, I have very high tech cameras that I've acquired, but I'm never going to use them for Intellis. Now, if I start a new series, I might retire my Sony Handycams and go completely digital with the next project I work on. But I think consistency is everything. I know I've mentioned this before, but the audience has to feel they know the parameters of your show. They have to know if they tune into an Intellis episode, whether it's 1 or 24 or 30, they know what they're going to get. And it's the same thing with my visual effects, my story style. It's got to be consistent. I really do mean it when I say it's one long story, and it can't feel weird or out of place. You know, it makes your audience jittery. You know, if I suddenly got $100,000 for one episode and it looks amazing, you know, it looks like ILM came in and, you know, suddenly I had giant sets to, it would look very weird. You might think it's cool looking, but it would be very, very weird. Just like if I ever had the chance to shoot on the Frank sets or where Van, you know, any of the Neutral Zone studio stuff, I couldn't call it Intellis. You know what I mean? Like, I'd have to make it a point to say, well, Holt Allen is visiting another ship.
Yeah.
Because it would look so great. It looks so different from my show that you have to account for it. You can't ignore it.
It would be like the difference between the original series budget versus the motion picture. You would have to have a defining reason for why there's such a distinct look. Because if you were to just say episode 13 is TOS looking, then episode 14 is motion picture looking, then episode 15 looks like Star Trek Discovery, where it's all dark and looks like they don't have power in the electricity. And it's just like, it's very jarring for the audience to tune in and go, what am I looking at here? And that's the one thing about you is consistency. One thing I'd like to kind of steer the conversation toward is your storytelling. This story, I felt, was it had the vibe of TOS, I felt, from the butterfly and dragon and just kind of the mystery of space. Like, a lot of people like to say, oh, we're going to fight the Klingons and pew, pew, pew. Or the Romulan bastards, I'm going to get them, you know, go warp speed. But you were like, nah, I think butterflies and flat dragons is where I'm going to go with this. Let's go down that route.
Crystal identity.
There you go.
Yeah, the crystal identity.
I felt it was very important that by introducing the quote unquote monster, that I wanted Holt Allen not to seek out to destroy it. I mean, in the episode itself, starships have vanished. It's a very serious situation. And obviously something is hurting or killing people. So obviously, you know, the most immediate reaction would be, oh, just kill it, you know, hunt it down and kill it. But I really do believe, because in real life, I love animals and, you know, if I can capture a spider and release it, I will, even though I'm terrified of them. But the idea being that Holt ultimately says, look, we don't understand what this creature is, but we shouldn't just set out to destroy it. Let's see if we can solve the mystery and, you know, and spare the creature. And so I was very pleased that it's a very true Gene Roddenberry TOS idea of, well, let's not just destroy it. Let's warn others about it. They know now not to fall for the lure of the butterfly trap. And if they know to avoid it, the creature will never be able to capture these ships, you know? So I was very pleased with that. I like the idea of Holt being, magnanimous that way. But at the same time, he does have a Druladanian side. He comes from that planet. And they have a very, very eye for an eye mentality. And then, of course, in my story, you see that when in episode 6, his solution is very, very, very hardcore. And of course, it plays out by episode 10, you know, the consequences of that. So, you know, the captain's got some dimension. That's by design. He's not one dimensional. He's not a mustache twirling villain. And he's not a perfect captain. He's got that conflict of culture. So he's got to use his judgment. So I thought this was a good opportunity to talk the talk, walk the walk. You know, he's a starship captain. They're supposed to be better than everyone ultimately. So that's sort of where I was at with that solution.
Well, I do like the fact that the one thing, like, he goes based on, like, he does talk to his crew and he goes to them for questions and, yeah, and he gets the advice of his crew. Like, it's not a, well, as you put it earlier, Mary Sue, you know, type character. Like, and this is on good display because you're talking to Sharb, you're talking to, I'm terrible with names, the Vulcan
That's
lady.
Right. To, you know, yeah, my
yeah, yeah, my favorite character. You know that Vulcan lady is my favorite character in your show. I love that character. You know that I was, before I found out about the stock footage, I was like, dude, can I have a scene with her? I love that. I love her. And you're like, I can't do it right now. And I was like, I know.
I'm sorry, man.
It's all good. And my heart was broken that day because of a Vulcan, you know.
Can I just say to you right now that sure, I'm sitting on this footage in the upcoming episodes, if you're mm-hmm. a T'Zrak fan, she mm-hmm. has got three episodes coming up, like, you know, in the remaining six episodes, a lot of screen time. I mean, I've been saving it, but if mm-hmm. you're a T'Zrak fan, you're in for a real treat coming up.
No, I will be the first one to be clicking that like button. So that's, I can't wait. But no, like, that's the thing I loved about this was the fact that you go to your crew, and I, you know, it's this is a very Star Trek episode. It's a great episode to turn anyone on to not only Starship Antilles, but just, hey, if you want a good feel good episode of Star Trek, turn on to this. You know, it may not have the budgetary, you know, of Star Trek, but hey, if you just like a good old classic episode of Star Trek, here you go. And the thing about this was, like, it doesn't feel like a claustrophobic bridge. It feels like, oh, this is a cool looking bridge set, and we got the people around, and you know, it's, you know, we got a Vulcan here, we got a, you know, Sharb, you know, and I love the fact that you explain it by, oh, we only use our mouths for eating, so.
Oh, so glad you remembered that. Yeah, that was awesome. Very important to mention that. Yeah,
I love that.
Because, like, I had that mask. I was a risk. I was really scared. I really was. I was scared, but I said, you know what? If we're going to go with the mask, we do have to account for why the mouth won't move. And I like the fact that Sharb said, look, I talked with my bracelet. I only use that for eating. I hope you understand. And I love that because it gives you a grounded reason why that creature won't talk, you know?
Yeah, no, it was very smart because, again, like, coming from a no budget production myself, it's like you have those constraints. Or, I mean, you could have gone the route of, well, slid the mouth open and do it poorly. And you were like, man, I'm not going to go there. I'm just going to, here's a real world excuse for, we only do it this way. And it, to me,
I did an animation test, Vance, where I did animate the mouth later in post. But I hated the way it looked. It didn't look
right. I think that would have detracted. I really think it would have. Yeah.
Well, you know, right on the money.
I was going to say, George, two things. First of all, I don't understand why you were, you know, worried about Sharb. You had him on. But the thing, but the thing I was going to say is what I enjoyed was the fact that you brought part of the crew that we had never seen before.
Yeah.
Five different people in there. And to me, you know, that just expanded upon the universe that, oh yeah, it's not just the bridge crew. He actually does have a crew below decks.
Yeah, yeah. I thought that was important, Frank. Yeah.
Yeah.
You will see more of them, by the way. Again, I always like to parcel out my footage. And I have been saving some of that, you know, as I'm concluding my last six episodes. Now I don't have the excuse of hanging on to any of this footage.
Yeah, right. There you go.
Yeah. So you will see. Yeah, you will see those. They were great people to work with. I wanted to show that that there were other members. As a matter of fact, not to give anything away, I have a film day coming up with a whole bunch of new people, beautiful young people that we haven't seen before that look good in the uniform. You know, they're just in the prime of life. And
not those of us who are prime beef. I mean,
yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I don't know if you guys knew this, but when I first wrote the captain's role, I was very heavy, and not in the way that you would think. I was bloated badly because I was suffering from an asthmatic condition, and the medicine they put me on bloated me terribly.
Oh.
And it had nothing to do with diet. It was water retention. And I said, you know what? And this wasn't vanity. Again, I try to ground everything you see with realism. And that's why by episode two, you find out that the captain is from a heavy gravity world. Because at the time, I didn't think I'd ever be able to shake the bloat. And that's why I think for the first two, three, maybe four episodes, I'm terribly heavy. But then they weaned me off the medicine. And then the weight started coming off. And so I just kind of dropped that aspect. It's not that it's forgotten. I just didn't need to mention it anymore because I lost over 100 pounds ultimately.
Wow.
Because at the height of my bloat, I was 263 pounds and I'm down to 160 right now. So it's a big difference in weight. But I didn't need to address it anymore. But I knew the criticism was going to come fast and furious. Oh, why is the captain so fat? And, you know, so I had to ground it in there's a reason for his physiology. But when I started losing the weight, I was going to address it originally. And then I said, you know what? I don't need to mention it. I don't think it's an important story point. But thank God I did. You know, thank God the bloat did go away. But my health has been, it's very tenuous. You know, my diabetes really kicked my butt very badly. And I had spent 11 days in the hospital. And it was really bad for a while there. But now it's under control again. So I survived long enough to hopefully finish my last six episodes and, you know, escape this whole process.
I just found out that I'm diabetic.
Oh, so I'm so sorry, Frank. Wishing on it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but fortunately, I don't know if you notice on the camera, but the day I found out, I stopped eating bread and everything else. And I've actually lost between 25 and almost 30 pounds in the last
sugar and the process. Yeah, Frank. Yeah.
Good job.
Yeah. So the thing is, as a matter of fact, I was at the doctor's yesterday morning, you know, for a checkup, and he was saying that he was very pleased with the fact that I dropped all the weight. And he said that hopefully now, because I haven't been to the diabetes clinic, I keep on not able to schedule, but I have a schedule next week. He said that he took my blood again, and he's hoping that we can control it with diet and no meds.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
They had put me on insulin, you know, the injection.
Oh, you were on insulin. Okay.
Yeah. I was so bad. My blood sugar was so off the charts. They actually had said to me flat out while I was in the hospital, they could not figure out medically why I was not in a coma. My sugar was so high. It wasn't close high. It was, they have never seen it that bad. And what happened was, they put me on the shots on the insulin and, for several months I was on it, but then the miracle of miracles happened where, you know, because I cut out all the nonsense, the process, the amount of sugar I was taking, I was drinking about 9-10 Red Bulls a day before I went to the hospital.
Yeah, that will
and
do
that
it.
Was, yeah, I was eating a box of donuts, you know, because I just eat my way through the day. I cut all that out and my blood sugar returned where my A1C was in the perfect zone. My blood sugar, which was over 300 at one point, which if you know your blood sugar, that is considered insanity. It's down to 140 now. My blood sugar is in the safe range. And but I didn't come out of it undamaged. Unfortunately, and hopefully you'll never be able to tell, both my feet are destroyed as far as my nerves. I can't feel both of them.
Oh.
I had to relearn how to walk without feeling my feet. And I don't know if you ever, I can't even describe to you what that's like. It's weird. It's like walking on air.
Yeah.
And if I don't look at the ground, if my eyes don't tell my brain where I'm at, I fall because there's no information going to my brain anymore. And since my blood has recovered, I got a little bit of feeling back in the middle of my foot, not my toes, not my heel, just a little patch in the middle of each foot. But it's not enough to keep me safe.
Yeah,
so I fall all the time. So when I act as Captain Allen, obviously I don't have that condition. I have to rehearse my path when I walk. So I do several takes so I don't have to think about what I'm going to do. But it's weird. It's weird not having your lower limbs. There's nothing they can do. Once your nerves die, that's it. It's a game over thing. And unfortunately, I just waited too long. And then once I left that hospital, I was alive, which was great, but not without collateral damage. But yeah, a lot of people don't know that about me. But yeah, I have not. It's been about over 2 years now. I've not felt my feet, and I miss it. It's very weird to miss a part of you. I feel like it's like an amputation. It must be like that, where you're missing your limbs, but you feel there's something down there.
Yeah, that phantom. I've heard of the phantom limb. Matter of fact, there's something that's going around that I've seen a couple times on YouTube and in the memes where they have this where they put a fake hand where you can see it. And they put your real hand on this side with a barrier, and you're stroking both the fake hand and that until you can actually feel that. And then they take the hammer and they hit it like that, on the fake, but you actually feel something. So, it's funny how the mind works.
It is. And I got to tell you something. For me, for acting, it's so good to get out of my own headspace. So when I play Hulk Allen, he's not a diabetic. He's not an asthmatic. He's not this 60-year-old human being. This is a guy who's massively strong. He's from a heavy gravity world. And I actually believe that. So for a little while, it's good to get out of my headspace and to play that character.
Yeah.
It just helps me,
There is a certain part of Hulk Allen that is George.
Right.
Yeah. And that is, it's like anything else. Every actor, I think, I can't say that, but I'd say that a lot of actors put themselves into their parts.
Yeah, I'm not a method actor, but I have enough of an imagination in my process that I could put aside me and think of myself as a captain. I really do try to give context of the things that you don't see on screen. I try to go like, what's his day like? What's happening? Oh, now he's on a mission. Did he wake up on the right side of the bed? Is he annoyed? I do try to give, and most people don't, you don't need to know that. The audience certainly doesn't care, but it helps my process for me to believe it.
The same way with Grissom, like I told Vance when he started writing, and when I started writing, I don't want to be Kirk. I want to be a slightly damaged person because I lost the dominion. I had part of my crew was killed because I wasn't smart enough to see that trap. And that's where Grissom started. So Grissom has a tendency at times to second guess himself.
Yeah.
So, I'm not damaged to the point where I can't command, but I have to have that reassurance to a degree, and I have to think about what I'm doing.
But he's very human, Frank, and that's what's great about that character. Star Trek, if nothing else, it's about overcoming those obstacles and doing your job. Technically, we're all professionals. Vance is Menard, you're Grissom, Maya Allen. We are in a position of authority, and we have to have enough of our act together or else we can't be in that center chair. But the audience loves also that reachability or that's something they can relate to, that despite the fact they have personal hangups, they're good at what they do. They can command a crew and they try to keep their personal stuff, off that bridge. But it's important for the audience to see that. That's the bare bones of drama. You need that. If you write your character as perfect, you better surround himself with damaged people so you have a little bit of contrast. Right. Otherwise, it's boring, anyone that calls, for whatever reason, particularly early in my series, Holt Allen, a lot of my critics were like, this guy's too perfect. He always guesses right. He always seems to, be a Mary Sue. And I was always like, well, you haven't seen my full story. He is trying to project that image of I know the answers, but we know that's not true. But then later on, when he is guessing right, I wanted to give a secret reason why he seems to be guessing right. Mm-hmm. And when that bombshell is released, I think it's episode 23, when you find out exactly why he's able to, you know, get that gut feeling. It's such a bomb, drop the mic moment, because it does show why he was able to do that. And it's like, oh, you know, and I designed it that way. So a lot of people wrote the character off early as I'm being narcissistic. They accused me of being a camera hog, you know. The other thing was all the close-ups. One of the major criticisms of my show is why so many close-ups. And the reality was, when I lost my original location, my original bridge, after 2013, I got married, I moved, I was already married, but, you know, we moved to another smaller place. The camera could not get any far, you know, any length or distance away from my actors. The only thing I had left was the tight medium or extreme close-up. And I could only hope to match what I had shot back in 2013.
You're in a small room.
Yeah, it's crazy. I had no choice, you know. Could not get the camera. I actually had my camera against the whatever wall was there, you know, as far back as I could.
But yeah, you have to do that sometimes. I mean, my ready room is not that big. And one time we had it in the back up there going, are we focused on anything?
It's only now that I'm back at my parents' house, you know, and I got, but even then I only got half the space, you know, that I had originally.
Yeah, before. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I still can't pull that camera back.
And all that stuff.
Well, the problem is the basement was now full of my parents' stuff in the interim in the last 10 years.
Of course.
I couldn't believe how little room I had, but I was able to still build that kind of horseshoe shape in the one side where I used to have both sides. But yeah, I cannot get that. I know I'm a filmmaker. They, you know, you can't, and it's not that I'm above criticism, but when they say why the close-ups, I answer them in the comments. I use close-ups, mediums, whatever I can, you know, but a lot of times, you know, you're stuck with what you got. You got to make use of what you can.
Well, it was like when people were picking on the fact that everything was a com box. Well, you know, what could you do during COVID? You weren't going to get people on the sets. Okay, if you want a fan film, what's the best way to do it? Com box.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think a lot of good things came out of com box.
Yeah, there's nothing
wrong with Vance
that.
Mastered that art of that style, you know. And I never thought of it after a while. Whenever I watched any of Vance's work, I just enjoyed his characters and his story. You know, it wasn't until after his show was kind of done and I went back and I rewatched a lot of his episodes. Anya and I love to do that. But that's when you kind of notice that style. You say, oh, yeah, I didn't even think about it, you know, but it makes complete sense.
But the thing is that's what a lot of people don't see. We are not out there to have the glitter and everything else and the super special effects. We're telling stories, and that's where a lot of people don't see it. They're not seeing that we're trying to tell a story. I mean, I could tell your story in TNG era. I could tell your story on Orville. You know, it just depends, because they're all stories that revolve. They have a theme. They have, in your case, a progression. Right. And you're trying to go someplace with it, and you have it all mapped out. I mean, what did Gene say? Wagon train to the stars.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's I think I talked to Jefferson about this. It's a. It is an advantage to knowing where you're going. It takes a lot of pressure off you. The tricky thing is to stick that landing. You know, so you have the idea, you have your fans, and then you have the wonderful actors like yourself, and you're hoping that all those elements come together. So when you get to that last episode, you want people to feel they it was worth the time and
worth the
ride. The
investment.
And that's really always, as a filmmaker, I feel a responsibility, particularly someone like yourself that's been with me so many years. You don't want to let them down. But at the same time, you know better than anyone, you got to be faithful to yourself. Because, you know, you got to tell your story. You got to be true to yourself and hope you have earned the right to be followed, you know. So, you know, my finale is slowly coming together now, and I'm pleased with it. It's very consistent, and hopefully it'll answer all those questions that, you know, people have been waiting for.
I kind of have mixed feelings on this. I'll be perfectly honest.
Yeah, tell me.
The reason is because I want to see the finale, but I don't want to see Antilles end.
Yeah. Well, we still have 6 episodes left. I mean, that's a long time, right?
I know, but that's what I mean. It's when it's like, you know, when Next Gen went off the air, when Enterprise got, you know, it's just that. Yeah. Oh, an era is gone for a while.
Well, you know, Frank, I can't thank you enough because, yeah, I've been asked, particularly as we're getting near the ending, I've had a lot of comments where people say, I don't want this to end. Why do you have to end it? And here's my thinking. And it's the same as being a graphic artist. You want your portfolio to get you the next job, but you don't want your portfolio to be so big that they're like, oh, there's more of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really did want to, and having Jefferson as part of this, I want people to love it for what it is, but not overstay its welcome. And I'd rather people say, boy, that was a great ride. I enjoyed it. I wish there were more, as opposed to say I went 10 more years and they go, I burnt out on these characters. The show is listless. It doesn't seem to have a reason, you know. So I always said from the beginning, I need to tell my story. Now, again, I did change my game plan a little bit because originally it was only 20 episodes.
Right.
And I said, you know what? I need more episodes to get to my ending. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I feel 30. It's a nice number. It doesn't overstay its welcome. And certainly long enough for you to get to know the characters. But I said this to Jefferson, too. If, for whatever reason, something at the end of the whole shebang, maybe a year goes by or whatever, and I say, oh, you know, I have something else to say with Antilles. I could always do a one-off standalone, like TV movie. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because I can always go back in time. That obviously, you know, I would never, the ending, I'm not giving it away. Don't worry. But the way it ends, you'll see why I won't continue it. But at the same token, I could always go back in my own timeline and say, oh, let's have another adventure. You know, it won't affect the overall story, but you might see these characters again, you know, I can only do that.
But so they use that ability to go in.
Yeah.
Dance does that all the time, if you look at it. He'll have the end, and he'll still be creating in there. It's sort of like, what was it with Slaughterhouse 5, where you wake up in the morning and then you live your life, get shot, wake up and do it again?
Yeah. I mean, I love these characters. Believe me, look, to be honest, I'm never going to get this kind of fan base no matter what I do. If you look at my other videos, my non-Trek projects, there's just not an audience for it, even though they like you.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the actors are from my Star Trek series, but people like what they like. They like Star Trek. It's its own bubble. And believe me, I could be selfish and say, well, if I want the views or if I want that kind of audience attention, I'll just stick with Star Trek. But, you know, I've been a filmmaker since 1978, I've done more non-Star Trek projects than Star Trek projects, but I'm mostly known for Star Trek, and that's great. But I do have all these other stories I wish to tell. I just need to do it as a filmmaker, but I'll never say never. And again, the reason why I do any Star Trek is an idea burns in the back of your mind that says it has to come out in this format. You know, I must come back to the sandbox. So if I ever get a hankering, say, to work with Jefferson again or you, Frank, and it's in a Star Trek context and it makes sense to do that, you know I would do it. I would gladly do it. But again, I really do believe in being at least faithful to the current plans. I'll finish my Antilles show and then reassess. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like, this is, of course, adding to it. It never gets done.
Yeah, you know, it's a tapestry, right. You know, does the bed need another pillow, you know?
I don't know.
But again, Star Trek's always near. It doesn't mean I'm walking away or I wouldn't be a fan. You know, I'll always look forward to seeing something Jefferson's in or you, Frank, or Vance. You know, I'm not walking away from fan films. I'm just sort of completing my ride for now. Now, whether that's temporary or my final adios, I don't know. And I'm not being coy when I say that. I'm not trying to milk the drama. I'm being very honest. But I can't even think ahead right now. I'm working on the last six episodes. I'm a little overwhelmed. I can't even imagine doing one more thing, you know?
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I was in Joseph Peters' cameo. He asked me to be in his Bomber Girl film. I had to shave for that. And I had to figure out a time I could shave, play the role that he wants me to play, and allow myself to grow my beard back to start, you know, filming again.
Well, that's going to be tricky.
It was tricky. Yeah. So I shaved, I filmed, I sent them the footage. I'm glad I did it, but it was like one more thing on my menu, you know, to do.
I had to do that for Dive because Vance wanted us to look younger. And I said, well, I should shave. So I shaved and I said, well, am I going to shoot? But not only that, it's not just this film, but I had stuff I'm doing for Rain Cross, stuff I'm doing for Vance again. So, you know, you got to be careful.
Yeah.
And you know, when you do things like that, because you got to keep consistency. So I said, well, it's going to be a couple weeks. I know how fast this thing grows back. And so I shaved it. So
I know. But nobody thinks about that, you know?
Nobody You're right. You're right.
I need about 4 days, you know, to get my beard. It's just starting to come back in. I need a good 4 days. But it's scary because then I'm always worried about that phone call where one of my actors goes, I'm free. And you're like, oh, I'm not ready. You know,
out there with the.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God. You know.
Yeah, like this masterpiece right here, this takes a few weeks to get. And then it gets full after about a month or so. So, yeah, if I had ever had to play my character as a younger version, I'd have to be careful with, you know, if shaving becomes one of those things, because with no hair up top, I want to go with a mustache. Like if I did anything to look younger, I wonder what I'd look like in a mustache. It's been a long 70s time since
mustache.
I've done that.
70s mustache.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a porn star.
Exactly. Jefferson, you got a very young looking face, though.
That's right.
You know, the facial hair does add like another dimension of depth for you. But you got a really young looking face. I could see if you shaved completely, you know, you could play a character much younger. It's like that poor Michael J. Fox's disease really kind of wrecked him. But, you know, he stayed young for many decades, you know.
Yeah.
You have that. You know, younger look.
Which, thank God, because I'm going to be 47 this fall. Oh, and
so young. You're so young.
Baby.
I'm going to be 50 in June.
Hey, but where's my baby powder?
It's crazy. But you know what's funny? In real life, you want to stay young as possible.
Yeah.
But one of the cool things about getting into acting is you can appreciate your wrinkles. For example, I've always looked younger than what I was. But I'm going to be nearly 60. So if people look at me and say, even though with the gray, he looks late 40s or 50s or what, but that's still old enough to play a captain.
Yeah.
I could defend it. I could say, look, if you look at me close up, I got the wrinkles. I got the gray hair. You can't accuse me of being too young to be a captain. And so in a weird way, I'm grateful for it. You know, the facial wrinkles, you know, it adds a little bit of a maturity to it, you know?
Yeah, but
people have told me I should be commanding the USS Noah's Ark. But anyways.
No way, Frank. No way. You don't look that old, though. Unless you let
I'm
your
70, George. Out. I'm 70.
Frank, you've been on the bridge since Jesus was an ensign.
I think it was a midshipman, as a matter of fact.
Right. The only way I'd accept Noah's Ark is if you grew your beard like down to the middle of your chest, you know, with that really long. That's the only way I would accept that. Because again, you look much younger. Seriously. I know age is just a number and it really does depend on your personal health. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I was in my 20s, despite my asthma, you know, I couldn't gain an ounce. I could eat and run. I missed that time. So, you know, then middle age kicks in, you got gravity, and then, you know, now suddenly it's like, you know, diabetes is like becomes the dominant factor of your life. So, you know, you got to use it to your advantage. So obviously I'll never play an ensign. So if I look old enough to play a captain, I'm grateful for that,
right?
You know, because that's where our believability comes in. Honestly, I mean, like, and I'm sure Jefferson, you probably feel the same way. When you look at characters and they're too young, it takes you out of it a little bit. You know, if you have kids playing bridge officers and they're all very young, good for them for being young. But as an audience member, right, you're going to look at that and say, are you really bridge officers or are you kids playing bridge officers?
Yep.
It's very important that people look age appropriate.
Yeah. You know,
to give it a level of realism.
You're right. And I want to wrap us up because our goal of a 30-minute discussion was overshot by an additional 30 minutes. but you're absolutely right. There have been films that I've watched where you're correct. It looks like you're seeing kids as officers on the bridge, and it kind of takes you out for a little bit. But George, thank you so much for joining us tonight and talking about your film, this episode 12 specifically, and just the story as a whole, and all of your stuff inside and outside of Star Trek. So I appreciate you with that and looking forward to seeing more of your films.
Oh, great. Thank you, Jefferson, so much. And Frank and Vance, you know, you guys are like family to me. And yeah, let's do another episode. You know, there's always more to talk about.
That's great. All right.
I agree. And I enjoyed talking to George.
Thanks, Frank.
Yeah, I really do. You too.
Me too. Okay. So the audience, thank you for watching or listening. Live long and prosper.
If you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us at patreon.com/beyondtrek.
We are Beyond Trek Podcast. Lower your inhibitions and surrender your years. We will add inspirational and hilarious Trek content to your day. Your attention will adapt to subscribe to us. Resistance is futile.